In 2019, I did my first Everest attempt, and I literally spent the entire month of April and May out in Nepal. It took about 2 weeks to get into base camp, just trekking along and getting acclimatized there. And I had a team of total of three, just really amazing people. One gentleman by the name of Chris Pollock is somebody who has climbed a few of the different seven summits, if you will, with me. And then Rob Galler was my cinematographer. So I'm really lucky that I was able to have somebody so great to fill the entire expedition. But it was a very small group because we selfishly have to move at my pace. The more people that you have, obviously the more variables and the whole nine. So we kept it small to move, like, just elitely, I guess, if you can say that. But 2 weeks in the base camp, and then I did everything very unconventionally. I did things super old school. I actually spent what would be a couple of weeks at base camp. I guess about 9 days at base camp, really. And then I actually never came down below camp one for about a month, which is insane. Might actually have a record for being above 6,000 meters. So yeah, I spent a month above about 20,000 feet. Most of the time people would go up to camp one, back down to base camp, up to camp two, back down to base camp. And instead I just needed to go for it because it wasn't worth the risk of me trying to go through the Khumbu icefall time and time again on one leg. The reality is, like, the energy that I would have exerted to do that, could have been detrimental. But on the flip side, I mean, let's face it, you have one leg and you're going across ladders that are, you know, 3, 4, 5 long that are tied together with shoestrings. There was just a lot of variables that kept me above camp one. Honestly, you mentioned the traffic, and I don't want to toot my own horn, but, you know, me and my team were pretty wise in that. I never stood in a single line. I actually went to the first weather window. I made a very bold move by doing what we call threading the needle. So I went for a very short weather window, and I actually chased the rope fixers up all the way up to the south summit.
How close were you to them? Like 100 yards, you know, half mile?
We may have been a couple hours. I mean, it's hard to say half mile when you're up there because, your body doesn't move. A half mile could be like 8 hours, but we were a few hours behind them for sure. But it was a huge risk and a huge gamble, but it was worth it to make it up, you know, as far as we could, and not be stuck in those traffic lines, running the risk of me having frostbite on my residual limb or obviously dying. We decided to do things a little bit differently.
Yeah. In terms of the seven summits, was that the last one, or which ones have you finished and which ones do you have left?
No, so technically I am, thank God, halfway through this, four of the seven being done. And I'm doing what would be, it's called the Explorer's Grand Slam. So the highest point in each of the seven continents is in the North and South Pole. So I still have to go back for Denali, and then I still have to go back for Mount Vincent and in turn do the South Pole while I'm down there. So still have a lot of work to do, but hopefully we accomplish it all successfully pretty soon.
Absolutely. And were you a climber before the sort of crash? Or, you know, what drove the climbing? I mean, it's something that's, you know, unbelievably impressive on its own. You know, forget the whole on one leg, as you like to say. You know, what drove that? What drove the seven summits versus, you know, your biking, swimming, or all of the above?
So I'm originally from Florida. Obviously, know nothing about altitude, winter or snow. And after I got hurt, I just really needed something that could give me the confidence that I could go out and do whatever I wanted to, regardless of my injuries. And there was an organization that reached out to me while I was still in the hospital, and they said, "How do you feel about learning a winter sport?" And at the time, I could care less. I just wanted anything that would get me out of the hospital.
Sure.
And they said, you know, we can bring you to Colorado and we can teach you how to ski or snowboard. And I got my medical clearance. My doctors initially told me, no, you can't do anything but sit ski because of your traumatic brain injury. And when I got to Breckenridge, Colorado, no one actually asked me for my medical clearance, so I said I wanted to snowboard.
Of course, learned how to snowboard. Right, of course you did. Yeah. Right.
And I actually picked that up really quickly and really well and started competing alongside Team USA, became the USASA national champ and best in the world, and it was all just very much so second nature. But back in 2015, I got very sick and lost the racing season and decided that I was going to try and turn to the mountains in a different way. And it was going to be by rock climbing and mountaineering. And I don't think I realized what any of it would turn into. You know, I decided that I was going to climb Kilimanjaro to raise money for clean water for the East Tanzanians. And it ended up taking off. We raised something like $150,000. And I realized that I just loved mountains. And I loved, you know, challenging myself and forcing myself to put one foot in front of the other and showing myself that my, you know, my mind is stronger than my body. And I decided then and there on Philly that I was going to try and do what's called the Explorers Grand Slam. And I never wanted to do it as a means, like, to beat on my chest or for pride or ego or just to look what I can do. It was more so, like, I don't know. I wanted there to be passion and purpose behind it. So all of my climbs, you know, I've done to raise money for different nonprofits or to bring prosthetics to underserved countries, basically.
That's awesome. And to talk a little bit, I mean, you bringing the prosthetics to, you know, Tanzania and some other places, where do you, you know, are you able to, you know, kind of deliver them to the villages, the towns, to the, you know, kids, adults? How does that work? Are you, do you have relationship with doctors?
Well, I mean, it obviously depends. Like, I with Everest, I started working with a nonprofit called the Center for Disabled Children Assistance. And, you know, they don't have prosthetists in Nepal or really, quite frankly, in India. But what they do need and can actually accommodate is wheelchairs and wheelchair parts. So I, like, joined up with them, tried to figure out, you know, how I can get prosthetists over there for longevity. You know, I don't want a four-year-old kid to get a leg for 3 months and then him outgrow it and not be able to, like, you know, have it later on down the road.
Sure.
So we sat down and came up with a plan how to bring those supplies, those resources, you know, the, obviously the medical expertise to be able to get these kids their prosthetic limbs. But, you know, more so with them, we decided that wheelchairs were going to be more powerful and more impactful. Now, what I'm going to go down and do in September in Ecuador is we're going to be bringing, like, recycled prosthetics. So here in the U.S., you know, we are very fortunate. Don't get me wrong. I understand that we pay tons of money to be able to be cared for medically, and the prosthetics world is extremely challenging, especially when it comes to just insurance in the whole nine. But we waste a huge amount. And
sure.
Some people like me, you know, I'm on a simple prosthetic leg. It's indestructible. It's waterproof. It's honestly meant for, like, a diabetic in a wheelchair. But I'm taking it all over the world and climbing. And for whatever reason here in the U.S., we have people thinking that they need these crazy $100,000 knees that can essentially walk for them to go on, you know, living a normal, healthy life. And that's not the case. So what I'm doing is going behind these people and taking their old knees and old feet and repurposing them and bringing them all around the world.
It's the equivalent of sort of trading in your old running shoes, but in a much more compelling way. That's pretty cool. Talk a little bit about the heat sheet. Did you have a chance to, you know, use any of them, or your team use any of them when you're on Everest? And if so, you know, how did you use it? I'm always curious. It's easy for us, because we see it in the, you know, at the end of marathons, you know, in the U.S. and internationally a little bit, but what we don't, I guess, have a fuller appreciation of sort of how people are using it in kind of distress situations. Not that yours is necessarily distress, but we're sending a lot more into the military, et cetera. And so I'm always curious to see how things are used in real life. Did you have a chance to use any of them when you're up there?
Yeah, actually. So, to be totally transparent, I'm not afraid of anything, really. I'm not afraid of getting
hurt. I'm not
afraid of
death.
I'm not really afraid of what most people would be afraid of on the mountains, but what petrifies me is frostbite. And the reality of that is, like, I can't get frostbite on my residual limb. If I do, I have only a few inches of femur left, and that would mean that I'm going to be a hip dysarthric, and the reality of that is I would probably have to live my life in a wheelchair, and that's not what I want. I was at about, 28,000 feet, and and I'm actually sweating. I'm in my summit suit. It's like negative 30 degrees. I'm sweating. I'm miserable. I'm actually fairly ticked off, too. And my leg's falling off. It's breaking suction. It's just sweating straight off. And the last thing that you want to do is, you know, expose your residual limb when it's soaking wet to negative 30 degrees. And so, I mean, my heat sheets came out right off the bat. And that's how I keep my leg warm. In the meantime, you know, it's hard to keep water hot up there. So people are breaking out jet boils to be able to warm water up to warm my leg up. And the heat sheets, you know, the emergency blanket kept my leg warm. You know, I'm not saying it to, like, fluff anybody up or to make anybody feel good, honestly. But, it, you know, it really does. It's a game changer in what I do.
That's awesome.
It kept my limb healthy, and it's allowed me to continue doing what I'm doing. You know, I can give you a whole bunch of other examples of what it was used for. I mean, hell, there was times that it was even used to reflect light at one point. So in the valley between Camp 2 and Camp 3, it gets insanely hot. People think it's freezing on Everest most of the time, but no. You know, the sun reflects off of the snow. People are getting, like, sunburns and blisters on the roof of their mouth, inside of their nostrils. So half the time, you know, we're covering ourselves in emergency blankets just to be able to keep the heat off of us, but then also reflect it off of all of our gear and everything else. So, you know, there are those examples, but I think the ones that are really important are, you know, you need to have these things in your emergency kit, because I've been there, you know. I mean, had I not had what I had to be able to put my leg back on, then I wouldn't have been able to keep going.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad we could help out a little bit. So did you reuse them? I mean, were you able to kind of repack them and use them more than once?
Yeah, well, that was my main attraction to them, actually. Obviously, being able to get them out and being able to use them, it not being a total hassle, things sticking together and all of that. But to be able to say, hey, I'm going to refold this, throw it back in, and not have to carry 3, 4, or 5 of them to be able to do the same purpose. I mean, that's huge. Obviously, every ounce matters when you're climbing. So be able to carry one. I mean, mine were pretty wrecked when it was all said and done. So if you guys want to send me some more, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, are there any changes you would make to any of them? I mean, were they too long, too short? Did you use the bivy, which was kind of a sleeping bag thing? Or did your team use any of that? I mean, what were the ones... What is the most useful, I guess, product in the heat sheets line? Is there anything we can do to make it easier for you, given that sounds like you're going to need them again at some point here,
yeah.
Rather than later?
So the bivy, I mean, obviously we tested it out to be able to bring it up high. I said, well, all of our stuff, but I didn't have to use it up high, but will it make it into my kit time and time again? Absolutely. It's tried and true, and it's durable. I mean, there's a lot of people out there making products that say that they can withstand the elements, if you will, but they're not being put to the test of, I mean, like what I went through on Everest. And for any sort of product to be able to withstand, you know, extreme winds, obviously freezing cold, at times insanely hot weather, snowstorms, ice storms, all of the above, that actually, I mean, it really says something. On the flip side of that, what did keep me very warm, when I'm climbing, you know, most of them might be in a summit suit, but because I naturally run hot and in turn sweat a lot, one of the things that we would do was actually keep me in a very lightweight, puffy, and then put the hooded emergency blanket. I don't know the technical term for it, but the hooded emergency blanket, and have me actually move in that. And I don't know if you guys ever read my blogs at all. I mean, I think I'm a half-ass writer, but. But when I was actually moving from Camp 2 to Camp 3, it was a pretty risky move to start with, just because we didn't know where any of our equipment was. It was a very last-minute call. And so for me to be able to sit in my tent, you know, at 10 o'clock at night, 24,000 feet, and actually be comfortable and not have to fret about what's going on with all of my down gear, again, I mean, that's just a testament to what you guys do and what you guys create.
Thank you so much. That's a heart warmer, because I wish I could say that. Actually, I don't wish. I am not strong enough to do the Everest stuff. I'm more than happy to try to kill myself in many ways, but being cold is not one of the things I'm particularly. So walk a little bit through sort of like, you know, where your head was at, you know, once you guys determined, frankly, appropriately, particularly given it was in the news, on sort of not being able to get pushed all the way to the summit. You know, how did, what was that decision like? Was it easy? Was it, you know, was it just such the obvious call that it made it easier? What was going through your head?
No, I mean, it tore up my heartstrings. I mean, I was super proud. I mean, I'll send you a video where you can literally see the summit and what I'm dealing with and what I'm processing. But making it to the South Summit when everyone told me that I couldn't or that I wouldn't make it above Camp 1 or Camp 2 as an above knee amputee, like, it was hard. Turn around. I mean, I wanted so badly to, quite frankly, give the middle finger to everybody and say, hey, look, I did it. But
yeah.
I can't not be proud of what I did. I mean, there's a reason no one else is doing it, and they haven't made it that far. You know what I mean? Like, I put a lot into it, blood, sweat, tears, obviously every penny of my freaking savings account, training. I jeopardized family, relationships, time. But, you know, I was about, gosh, maybe 100 feet above my climbing partner when they realized that if they kept going, they wouldn't have enough oxygen. And looking down on them and seeing the fear on grown men's faces, there's not a question. And nothing that I love or that I'm passionate about is worth the blood of life. So I hope that makes sense. Like, it was that red
good for you. I mean, well, what was the view like up there, right? I mean, that's a view that, like, so few people on Earth have seen, right? Like, that high up. Was it quiet? Was it noisy because of the wind? I don't know if you do meditation or anything like that. I'm a big proponent. I mean, walk me through sort of, you know, what goes through your head when you're, you know, standing on a place that, like, so few people on Earth have actually stood on, and frankly, no one, you know, sort of with your challenges has ever done or even come close to, frankly. I mean, what do you think about it times like that?
You know, honestly, I really wish I had this, like, insanely powerful answer to give you, but I think because I was out there for so long,
yeah.
You almost become, like, desensitized to it. So, like, when I was standing on a ridge line at, again, probably close to 28,000 feet with a 1,000-meter drop on both sides of me. And I'm looking around and I'm seeing all of these things. All of these huge peaks. It clicks in your head that, hey, I'm in the Himalayas and I'm doing something unreal. I'm, you know, chomping at the bit.
Florida girl sitting in the Himalayas, right? I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah. So you, like, think about all of those things, but at the same time, especially for someone like me, I'm like, stop looking up, girl, and look at your feet.
time to move, right? Get going, right?
Yeah, the whole thing is, like, you just keep your head down and do what you need to do. But there's seconds where you can actually, like, pick your head up and embrace, you know, what's taking place around you. I guess the easiest way to explain it is you're humbled. You are small. And, I mean, being able to experience mountains in that way, like, you realize that your problems don't matter. And actually, you don't matter.
It's pretty prophetic, right? So, and, you know, what is, you know, similarly, like, you know, what if there's one thing that you could take away, you know, other than, I'm sure the you know, something along the lines of "you rock" is in there, but, like, you know, what was, like, the, you know, what's the one thing that you'll take away from that, you know, experience? Is that even a fair question? One or multiple things that you'll take away?
You know what? The biggest thing has definitely been just embracing failure. I think for whatever reason, our society has cultivated this mentality of fearing failure, and that prevents a lot of people from trying. And I would love to sit here and say that I trained really hard and I worked my tail off and it was going to be a guaranteed summit of Everest, but that's not the case. I don't control what that mountain does or what that mountain or weather wants to do. And so I think, yeah, those are the biggest things, like being able to say, hey, I'm okay with failing if I'm willing to give this one my all, because maybe there's somebody else, you know, out there watching, you know, and I hope somebody is watching and says, you know what, I can do it better, faster, or stronger than Kirsty. And then they go out there and try.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's awesome. You want to talk about a little bit about your, you know, the foundation, sort of, you know, next couple of adventures? You mentioned, you know, the big bike races or bike rides coming up for 2021. Anything that, you know, we can do to kind of, you know, help your mission in terms of the your foundation and other things?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So to basically legitimize what I was doing by doing all of these crazy endurance adventures was, you know, trying to raise money for the nonprofit. And by creating my own 501c3, the foundation, which Kirstiana's foundation, real original, I was able to appeal to more people and be able to really push this thing as being a real concept or, you know, a real way of life. And so I'm trying to do a number of things that just aren't being done by disabled populations. And the end game is really, I just want to see more men, women, and kids out, whether it's outside and on the mountain or just outside in your front yard for an extra 30 minutes. I want to inspire people just to do more, you know, to use a little bit more of their potential, but then also, like, try something new. Because the moment you try something new, it's going to give you a whole new world of confidence that, I mean, you can undertake anything.
Well, that's awesome. Oh, good. You know, good for you, right? Like, total inspiration. I don't even forget the fact that you've only got one leg. It's just freaking inspirational, right? It's cool. I don't know. Do you have any questions, you know, for us? You don't need to, but are there any questions that you have for Heat Sheets or that I can potentially help you answer? Or do you have any, you know, thoughts on, you know, other ways we should try to get our product out there, you know, above and beyond what we did with you, either with your, you know, military brethren or, you know, adventure crazy brethren, whatever, right? You're right.
Well, I think my only question really would be, what's next? Like, what other things do you have in the works? So I'll let you start with that. But
yeah. Well, you know, I think what we're trying to really, you know, provide, you know, our products, you know, and I don't think survivalist isn't the right way, but, you know, if you're thinking about these, you know, these military guys, particularly in the mountainous regions where we find ourselves in Afghanistan, et cetera, right, it seems like there's a big pull or desire from the guys that are at the tip of the spear to kind of have products like this. And so one of the things we've really tried to work on is, you know, get awareness of the Heat Sheet product, you know, to the guys that and gals that matter, right? You know, and we're proud that it's made in the U.S. We're proud that it, but more proud, frankly, that it just works, right? And so, you know, any thoughts and guidance on how we might get it into the hands of those kind of folks, right? And have it do more. It's one thing to make people, you know, more comfortable after they finish a marathon, and it's awesome. That's a heck of an accomplishment. But, you know, we get, you know, occasional stories about people that survived mountaineering or, you know, better yet, helped save one of their buddies' lives, right? That's why we do what we do. And, you know, if you have any thoughts or guidance, you don't need to, but if you have any, that'd be awesome.
Well, I mean, I think what you guys honestly have is pretty dang special. You have a quality product that you can stand behind. You have a mission that you're passionate about. And ultimately that means that you have the power to build what you want to build. Your product can, like, grow an entire community of, you know, whether it's an adventure athlete or your person that's doing something solely endurance, like, you, I mean, the power is in your hands, like, really have those people gravitate towards you. And it's just what you guys, you know, I guess, want to build of it. But with that said, I mean, there's people like me out there that I want to see you guys succeed, and I'm so proud to be a part of everything that you guys have going on. So if you have a constructive criticism for me or say, hey, you know what, we thought you were going to do this instead of this, or how about, you know, you bring our product on, you know, whatever else is going on, like, I'm happy to do that. And I think because of what you guys are doing, you're attracting the right people. And I certainly think quality is way more valuable than quantity, especially when it comes to just longevity and what you guys can have over time. I hope that made sense. That was a total tangent. So.
You know, thanks for saying that, right? Like, look, and I can't imagine anyone saying anything to you about, you know, sort of, boy, you said you were going to do this and you did that, right? Those people, in my view, you know, go pound sand, go eat shit. I don't know what you're right. Sort of like, probably, Brian's like, I can't believe you just said that, Chris. But, right, but look, we're, you know, for what it's worth, right, we were, when we had the opportunity to do it, we were, you know, very happy to do it. And if there's things we can do, you know, for you or your team, you know, going forward, please reach out. You have our email. You have the contact information. We'd love to continue to kind of, you know, help you out, right? You inspire us. You inspire everyone else. But to be honest, and I think that's awesome, but as an adventure athlete that is, you know, dramatically not as accomplished as you, it's really, I just want to see you do it for you, right? That's the inspiration for me. That's really cool that you're you know, getting out there and doing it. So congrats to you. Hats off.
Oh. Thank you.